is knowing.
All right, man. Welcome to Crow 777 Radio. This is hour one of episode 614. It is me and Jason, and we are taking aim at the Bush family. Welcome, Jason.
And a pretty lovely afternoon, actually.
Well, that's not too bad. We have been very, very cold, so when it's decent, it's decent. But I want to mention a few things here. There's a free PDF you can find online, written by a man named William Guy, G-U-Y, Guy Carr, C-A-R. The name of the text or the book is Pawns in the Game. Jason and I will be doing an episode on this. It is basically about the onset of the actual Illuminati, not the nonsense you see now with celebrities and, you know, all this other ridiculousness that you see online. The celebrities are basically just decently paid tools. They're nothing more. We're talking about the real guys who started this supposedly back in 1776. And in the text, it includes his 24 or 25 bullet points of how they are going to take over the world. The reason I am mentioning that is because we're in the end game now, just like the Marvel movie told you in 2019 or whenever it was. By the time this decade is out, we probably sooner than that, we will know exactly how this game has gone. Also, Jason, I want to mention a few of the things that we sponsor and support. If folks remember back to what happened in Hawaii, there were reports of people who felt like their skin was burning and they jumped in the ocean. It is my point of view that people with a lot of heavy metals in their body, when exposed to very high frequencies like microwaves and things like this, could experience things like this. It is my point of view that it is critically important to detox yourself of heavy metals because of all the frequencies we are surrounded with and what could happen if they were pulsed. As a matter of fact, and I think I'm a minority on this, when Covidius Minimus broke in New York and all the people started losing their smell, the infighting began because many people were saying, this is fake, this is a ploy. And other people were saying, shut your mouth, I know somebody, I am somebody who's experienced this. I think it is quite possible that it was the frequencies. And lastly, if you've ever read the book, The Invisible Rainbow, you will see incontrovertible evidence that the common flu is caused by electromagnetic concerns. It cannot be passed by breath or secretions from the body. Anyhow, with all that said, on our sponsored page, there's a product called Masterpiece, which people have been pretty darn happy with as a cursory way to start getting metals out of you. Also, from the episode where we just recorded, Cultivate Elevate has a sponsored link with all kinds of products that can help. Good, solid, proven supplements. For the Masterpiece, you need to click on the image to get the discount. It's built into the price. For Cultivate Elevate, you need to use the code CROW10. There's two R's. CROW10. And I don't usually take all this effort to push these things, but we're in the end game. And I think it is critically, critically important that people make an effort to get the metals out of their body. Anyhow, Jason, is there anything you want to add to that?
Just that these are things we have used or still are using on a regular basis. Definitely true for me.
True for me. Me and my wife use them every day. I use the Masterpiece twice a day. And people can go see the studies where after 30 days of, I think they say 5 drops twice a day under the tongue, I think is how they direct you. They've seen levels, detectable levels from tests go down by up to, I think, 80%. And there are a lot of people that are going to argue and say, you can't, you know, totally detox this way. And I agree. It's a long process. But anything you do that gives you a measurable result, it helps and it's important. I think there is a very good chance that if we do reach that, I think we're alone now moment from that Dinklage movie, it will be something like a frequency pulse or something like that. But who knows? It's impossible to know without a crystal ball. But Jason, you did a lot of work on the notes we're about to go through for the Bush family. Is there anything you want to preface before we jump in?
So if you're hearing this episode, hopefully you've heard the previous one on the military-industrial complex. Now, while this one isn't a direct sequel to that, a lot of the stuff that goes on here intertwines with all of that. So this will be an extension in some ways of the military-industrial complex.
All righty. This is a hell of a tale. And for anyone who pays attention, you know, all these presidents are related. And I would urge people not to be fooled by the election we just had. You do not vote for these people. The system that was put in place seats whoever's going to get seated. This idea of stolen elections or this guy magically got in it. No. The Electoral College does that. And it's all the worse when you see people doing things like killing the IRS, which in any other time would be a pretty amazing thing to have been done. But right now, it's being done for a reason. One of those reasons is the global puppets want you on UBI. So just don't lose track here. And we're going to cover this family, which is as insider baseball as it gets with the New World Order.
The Bush family are quite a well-known American political family who can trace their lineage back for hundreds of years to England and Germany, with their European origins dating back to the 17th century. However, for the purposes of what we need to discuss, we will be going back to the 1800s in the United States, where we will begin with Samuel P. Bush, who was an American steel industry executive and is considered the patriarch of the Bush family. The Bush family has members that have held various national and state offices that span across four generations. So we will also be covering Prescott Bush, his son George H.W. Bush, and then finish with H.W.'s sons, George W., and a mention about Jeb.
So we're going to get into a lot of things here, and now people are focusing back on the JFK assassination or the staged things that we were shown. The point I'm making is the old school CIA members, back when there was still decency, they had two gangs, supposedly. The one gang was what they called the Whitebeards. These were the old guys that still had some decency left in them, supposedly. And they called all the new ones that are involved in what we're about to talk about something like the snotty-nosed Bush brats. I'm not even kidding you. Go ahead, Jason.
Samuel Prescott Bush lived from October 4th, 1863 until February 8th, 1948. He was born in Brick Church, New Jersey, and was educated at the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey. There he graduated with a degree in mechanical engineering in the year 1884. He took an apprenticeship with the Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, Chicago, and St. Louis Railroad at the Logansport, Indiana shops. He later transferred to Denison, Ohio, and Columbus, Ohio, where in 1891 he became master mechanic, then in 1894, superintendent of motive power. In 1899, he moved to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, to take the superintendent of motive power position with the Chicago, Milwaukee, and St. Paul Railroad. In 1901, Bush returned to Columbus to be general manager of Buckeye Steel Castings Company, which manufactured railway parts. As should be no surprise to anyone, the company was run by Frank Rockefeller, the brother of oil magnate John D. Rockefeller, and among its clients were the railroads controlled by E.H. Harriman. The Bush and Harriman families were closely associated at least until the end of World War II. In 1908, Rockefeller retired and Bush became president of Buckeye, a position held until 1927, becoming one of the top industrialists of his generation.
And so in the modern era, what do we refer to the people who were owning and operating the railroads? We called them the robber barons. Because the wealth discrepancy for the first time was so off the charts that it can't even really be quantified, probably. But interestingly enough, as you said, the name E.H. Harriman, if I'm not mistaken, isn't that the name that is dropped when Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid are robbing the railroad in the classic 1960, I'm going to say 8 or 9 movie, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid? When they're robbing the railroad, the guy inside won't open the door because I think he says, I work for E.H. Harriman, if I'm not mistaken. So many things being offered that just whistle by us because we don't know. But the main point is, all the way back to where Jason is starting from this family, they are in tight with the so-called robber barons.
In 1901, he joined the Buckeye Steel Castings Company in Columbus, Ohio, where he eventually became president. Under his leadership, the company would become a major supplier of castings for railroad equipment. He was appointed to the War Industries Board in 1917, where he was responsible for coordinating the country's industrial output for the country's war efforts. Specifically, he oversaw the production of ammunition, artillery, and small arms. He also served on the Ordnance Committee, which was tasked with managing the design, procurement, and supply of military hardware. During World War I, Samuel helped oversee the conversion of civilian manufacturing plants to produce military goods. This effort involved not only logistical management, but also negotiating terms between the government and industrialists, which set precedents for how such relationships would function in future conflicts. His work at this time earned him the nickname General Bush. This is an excellent early example of the military-industrial complex at work. Once the war was over, he played a role in transitioning industries back to peacetime production. His involvement in this process highlighted how interconnected military needs and industrial capabilities had become at this early stage. In the 1920s, Samuel P. Bush would serve on the board of the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland, as well as the Huntington National Bank of Columbus. His role with the Fed would have included oversight of monetary policy implementation at the regional level, monitoring economic conditions in Ohio, Kentucky, West Virginia, and parts of Pennsylvania, and providing input on issues like inflation, employment, and banking practices in the region. His involvement with the Federal Reserve Bank of Cleveland was an early example of where members of the Bush family were engaged with significant economic institutions, which would help provide a platform for future political and economic influence by his descendants.
This is what you call in like Flynn from the very get-go. But when you start to carefully consider what we're talking about here, you're looking at private industry. This is a private corporation that makes some product for America. And what happened here is the key ones get pulled into the war effort. And then the way they are retooled is not like we're waiting for the end of the war so we can go back to making couches and pillows. It's like we made so much money and had so much power where this wartime effort, when can we get into the next war? And I know that's a little simplified and overstated, but it's not wrong. And by the time you connect the dots from the robber barons to private industry becoming a military concern and negotiating directly with the government, somehow or other, you end up with the central banking system, which again is not federal. It is private. It has always been private.
Samuel P. Bush had five children with his wife, Flora, one of whom was Prescott Bush. He was born in Columbus, Ohio, on March 15, 1895, and lived until October 8, 1972. He attended St. George's School in Rhode Island before moving on to graduate from Yale University in 1917 with a degree in economics. While at Yale, he was admitted to the Zeta Psi fraternity and was a member of the infamous Yale secret society known as Skull and Bones. The Skull and Bones Society only inducts a small number of incoming seniors each year, typically around 15, from Yale's undergraduate population. The exact selection process is unknown, but it is said to be based on a combination of academic excellence, family connections, leadership, and sometimes sheer potential or character traits. Members of Skull and Bones form a network that lasts a lifetime, with plenty of evidence existing to back this statement up. The network would definitely include some of the most influential people in American politics, academia, and business, among other fields. Alumni are known to assist each other in various professional endeavors, which provided them unparalleled access to opportunities. Skull and Bones has become famous for its secretive rituals, symbols, and traditions. New members undergo a tap night, where they are tapped for membership, followed by initiation ceremonies that include oaths of secrecy along a similar line to Freemasonry. Their secrecy is strictly kept by its members, which includes what goes on inside their meetings and the exact nature of their activities. Members have been known to reach very high positions in government, which includes multiple U.S. presidents and senators, along with other influential positions.
I think what's on the surface here often gets overlooked. The people that are running these little world takeover things that have been going on. They're brilliant. Most of them are the smartest of the smart. I recently read some things about how the Jesuits back in the day picked their people, and it came down to you don't get in here unless your IQ is over 200. Of course, back in the day, they weren't doing IQ, but basically what it meant is if you are not astonishingly brilliant, we're not interested in you. And you can know this to be true by the simple fact of the stories we're told where they met some people that supposedly never saw white people before. And within a year or two, they have a Bible written in their language, and they're already moving them away from their language, you know, into the language they want. But this starts where he attends St. George's School in Rhode Island. And I don't want to mess this up, Jason, but I think that's a Jesuit school, isn't it?
No, not this one.
Okay, so yeah, I did. There's another St. George's, I think, that I'm confusing that with. As a matter of fact, this school, when I'm out driving, I can see it's in Newport, and it's a beautiful school. As a matter of fact, I have a clip from a long time ago where I went in there and filmed, and the Zodiac is in the aisleway on the way up to the altar. But to get back to the point, you know, we see people like George Bush and people, the junior, make fun of how dim-witted he is. But I think there's a good chance that's all an act, because most of these people are incredibly intelligent with very high IQs. And as you noticed when Jason was talking about the selection, I was going to make the joke that if you don't have the right blood, you're not in. But the truth is, they have been known to take some people surely because they're brilliant. And I would not be surprised if part of the secrecy here is enforced in the way the whole Diddy thing is going, where when you're initiated, you know, they get you to do something on film that guarantees you're going to be in line or something like that, maybe. But that is complete speculation on my part.
While still a junior at Yale, Prescott joined the Connecticut National Guard. He underwent officer training at the officer training camp at Plattsburgh, New York, where many Yale graduates, as well as other young men from elite backgrounds, received their initial military education. From there, he became a field artillery captain with the American Expeditionary Forces starting in 1917 when the United States entered World War I and would go on to serve in the battles of the Meuse-Argonne. There is a story that, while training at Fort Sill in Oklahoma, he participated in disinterring a skull that was rumored to be that of Apache leader Geronimo that was then conveyed to the tomb, which is the name of the Skull and Bones Clubhouse at Yale. After the war was over, Prescott began working for a St. Louis-based wholesale hardware business and, while there, met his future wife, Dorothy Walker. Her father, George Herbert Walker, had founded one of the Midwest's first investment banks and would become even wealthier heading up the Wall Street investment firm that was founded by two brothers, Roland and W. Averill Harriman, who did so with money inherited from their very wealthy father, railroad magnate Edward Henry Harriman. Prescott would then start a company that manufactured rubber flooring, which he soon sold but agreed to continue to manage, and moved to Massachusetts to do so. In 1925, he took a position with New York City-based United States Rubber, then relocating to Greenwich, Connecticut, where he would establish his family. In 1926, he joined his father-in-law's investment firm, W. A. Harriman and Company. In 1930, that company merged with the British American banking firm Brown Brothers, with Prescott becoming a managing partner in the new company, Brown Brothers Harriman and Company.
Quite a bit going on here, but let's just back up a little bit to the tale where he goes and digs up a skull. You got to wonder why they would call it Skull and Bones. Why does it have to be dark, right? Why can't it be something pleasant or beautiful or godly? But what we see is it's Skull and Bones, and that is reminiscent of the Jolly Roger flown by pirates, right? But if in fact he did go grab Geronimo's skull, what is that? Well, that is an indigenous person who lived on the land that they took away and then killed, right? Isn't that basically what it means? We killed you and took your land, and now we're going to use your skull as a little mantelpiece here and a symbol of what we're about. Anyhow, moving on, you know, we go from railroads to other things into the central bank, and now we're on Wall Street. And not only are we on Wall Street, this is partly owned British. And again, the name Harriman comes up. I almost want to go back and look at Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, because I now know that there was a reason that they're dropping that name. It's crystal clear there's a reason. But anyhow, go ahead, Jason.
The Business Plot was a political conspiracy that took place in 1933 and 1934 with the aim of overthrowing the government of President Franklin D. Roosevelt, then installing retired Marine Corps Major General Smedley Butler as a dictatorial leader in his place. Butler testified under oath before the United States House of Representatives Special Committee of Un-American Activities that multiple wealthy businessmen were plotting to create a fascist veterans organization with him as its leader and use this force in a coup d'etat to overthrow Roosevelt. There are some who claim that Prescott Bush was one of those involved in this plot. Interestingly, no one was prosecuted, but the Congressional Committee's final report stated, "There is no question that these attempts were discussed, were planned, and might have been placed in execution when and if the financial backers deemed it expedient."
I mean, there's a movie about this. Can you look up the movie real quick, Jason, the recent movie? People can see there's a telling of this tale. When you go through Marine Corps boot camp, and by the way, I don't suggest that anyone urges their children to do that, because if they do, they're going to be turned into a pincushion. I think I received something like 15 or 20 inoculations. Getting back to the point, one of the heroes of the Marine Corps that you're told about is Smedley Butler. There are two that you're introduced to who are the heroes. One is Chesty Puller, but Smedley Butler, according to all this, truly was a hero. In other words, these rich business people were going to make a run at the government, and a general actually acted like a decent, real human being and stopped it. And again, did you find the movie, Jason?
Is it Amsterdam?
Yes, that is it. The movie's name is Amsterdam, and it is some kind of a telling of what happened here. But think about what we're saying. You know, the whole idea of Adam Weishaupt in 1776 is basically a much longer, much more thorough idea of what happened here. In the movie, it's almost to the point of ridiculousness because it's a handful of people backed by other people. But the point is that one man, a general, doing what he swore an oath to do undermines the whole thing. And I'm just saying, you know, think about if huge numbers of us in this country stood up in the same way, how quickly things would change.
The Union Banking Corporation, UBC, was a New York investment bank that was incorporated in the United States in 1924. It would later be effectively dissolved in 1951. Prescott Bush was a founder and one of seven directors for UBC, which operated as a clearinghouse for many assets and enterprises that were held by German steel magnate Fritz Thyssen. Thyssen owned the largest steel and coal company in Germany and had grown quite wealthy from Hitler's efforts to rearm between the two world wars. He was also an early supporter of Adolf Hitler and financier of the Nazi Party, although he would later break from them, spending the last years of the war in various concentration camps. He survived, however, being liberated by American forces on May 5, 1945. Moving back to July of 1942, UBC was suspected of holding gold on behalf of Nazi leaders. A subsequent government investigation followed, which disproved those allegations, but confirmed Thyssen's control, and in October of 1942, the United States seized the bank under the Trading with the Enemy Act, holding the assets for the duration of World War II. This was part of a broader effort working to prevent American companies from trading with or supporting Nazi Germany. The UBC seizures was documented in the New York Times on October 20, 1942. There is documented evidence which directly shows that Prescott Bush was a director and shareholder of a number of companies that were involved with Fritz Thyssen. There seemed to be no serious repercussions to the Bush family as a result of either of these concerning incidents. However, from documents that were declassified decades after the end of World War II, it was shown that even after America had entered the war, and when there was already significant information about the Nazis' plans and policies, Prescott Bush worked for and profited from companies that were closely involved with the German businesses that assisted in financing Hitler's rise to power. Along with that, it has been suggested that the money Prescott Bush made from these dealings helped to establish the Bush family fortune and set up its political dynasty. To be fair, however, there has been no indicators that Prescott Bush was sympathetic to Nazi ideology.
I mean, it brings to mind the Who song, Eminence Front. If you've never heard the Who song, Eminence Front, go look up the lyrics right now. It's an Eminence Front. It's a put on. And all through the song, they repeat over and over. People forget. People forget. How is it that when the Bushes began to run for offices, this kind of thing didn't go right up to the top of the pops? Well, because the media is controlled. That's why. But then why wouldn't the opposing side go dig this up to defame them and do serious damage? Well, because the media is owned. That's why. And on we go here. But remember all the times I have said things like the bankers could determine whether a war starts and then who wins based on who is funded or not funded or how much funding? What you're looking at here is almost like Prescott Bush knew they needed an enemy, so he helped arm and finance the enemy they needed. I mean, what do you think, Jason?
Looking at all of this stuff, it seems that Prescott Bush was really dialed into a lot of things that a lot of folks might raise an eyebrow at.
The difference between the average human being and these people is we have a soft spot and a caring in our hearts for the place where we were born and the places we grow up. For these people, they could give a damn. They'll burn down the neighborhood they grew up in if they can get five more neighborhoods to replace it, basically. It's the way I look at it.
Prescott Bush was politically active on what are called social issues, being involved with the American Birth Control League as early as 1942 and serving as the treasurer of the first nationwide campaign of Planned Parenthood in 1947. These organizations, of course, had a lot to do with early eugenics philosophies and policies in the United States. Prescott Bush was also an early supporter of the United Negro College Fund and would serve as chairman of the Connecticut branch in 1951. From 1947 until 1950, he would serve as Connecticut Republican finance chairman and was the Republican candidate for the United States Senate in 1950. Prescott Bush's ties with Planned Parenthood were to hurt him in strongly Catholic Connecticut and were said to be the basis of a last-minute campaign in churches by Prescott Bush's opponents. The family had vigorously denied the connection at the time, but Prescott Bush lost to Senator William Burnett Benton by only 1,000 votes. He went for a rematch in 1952, but the Republican Party at the time chose William Purtell over him as their candidate.
People forget that way back in the 50s, the Catholic Church was a lot more conservative than it is now, to say the very least. Abortion was a no-go. Birth control was a no-go. Nothing like it is now, which is beyond uber liberal. They have just shredded the conservative values that used to be associated with that. And people like Michael Hoffman will go much further than I just have by pointing out things like Vatican II, which, what's that, the early 60s, I think? But come on, man. This guy is involved, and we have covered what Planned Parenthood was built for. It was built to further eugenics ideas. That's what it was about. And all the way back in the 40s, they're already planning to reduce human populations. And I think part of the reason for that is because they probably knew that when World War II came to an end, there was going to be a boom because all the men were coming home. But it's really hard to know for sure, but I mean, come on. How are you involved in eugenics ideas in 1942? Is it about population at that point? Or is it really just about getting rid of worthless eaters? You know, who knows?
We also know that Adolf Hitler got a lot of his eugenics ideas from people in the United States, some of whom were involved with Planned Parenthood. So there are connections all over the place here.
There are a lot of people of color that you can find on places like TikTok that are showing the damage that was intended to be done against the Black community, actually was done against the Black community, but like by places like Planned Parenthood, which is pretty damning when you understand that this man was involved with the United Negro College Fund. I think, and I would need to look this up, I didn't realize I was going to be talking about it, but I think somebody went back and looked up the percentages of Black abortions compared to white. And it is, it's no laughing matter. It is, it's ridiculous. And it's all the worse because if you look at the percentages of a country, and I can only guess without looking up what the percentage of African Americans to white Americans was, but I know it was a small number. So if you come back and say 38 or 40% of abortions, that is a damning number based on the statistics of how many people are in the country in the first place. But there it is. He was into the eugenics of Planned Parenthood, which was formed for that reason. And he was also playing the other side of the coin with the United Negro College Fund.
In 1952, Prescott Bush succeeded in becoming a senator in a special election that followed the death of Senator Brian McMahon. Prescott Bush won by a narrow margin against Abraham Ribicoff, who would later serve as governor of Connecticut and U.S. Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare. Prescott Bush's senatorial tenure would last from 1952 until 1963. As a member of the Senate Banking and Currency Committee, he was deeply involved in financial legislation and supported policies that aimed to stabilize the economy through government intervention, particularly after the war. He was a key supporter of the Federal Aid Highway Act of 1956, which authorized the construction of the interstate highway system, a project that was monumental in reshaping American infrastructure and economy. The way business is done today would not exist if not for the highway system, for better or worse. He also worked on legislation that related to housing, which included the Housing Act of 1954, which aimed at urban renewal and public housing. He served on the Joint Committee on Atomic Energy, which was instrumental in overseeing the nation's nuclear policies during the Cold War, and no doubt had huge ties to the military-industrial complex. Prescott Bush did endorse Eisenhower's economic policies, which included balancing the budget and maintaining a stable economy.
But way back then, we can't even think properly to consider this time period. We just can't. Things are so different. But when I was young and we used to drive from San Diego to Rhode Island every summer when my father was out of school, you would still see signs that attributed the highway system, the interstate system, to Eisenhower. As a matter of fact, if I remember correctly, you'd see the five stars that were his rank. Before that happened, Route 66 was the big deal, which came, I don't know, roughly somewhere near Chicago all the way down to the lower part of the West Country. I think maybe it came out in Los Angeles or something. I've forgotten. But the point I'm making is now there are all these highways going across, and it literally changed the landscape of what it meant to get around in this country. And not only that, that's how the car culture came to be. We were building the best cars in the world. Everyone loved them. And we had these road systems that we could go anywhere. So when you look at the big deal this was and you think, well, why did they do it? Did they do it for the benefit of everyone? You want to know what I think? I think that America was used by the globalists to advance technology, to get rich, to become a world dominator of sorts, and just used and abused at every step along the way. I don't think the highway system was put in for the benefit of the people. I think it was so we could move goods and services so that they could move whatever they wanted easily. I think that's why these things were done. And that's my very jaded point of view. But as we see now, they don't give a damn what they destroy. Look what's happened to our country in a single presidency. How much damage has been done. I'm just saying, Jason. I mean, do you think that's too jaded a point of view?
It's a bit jaded, but it was the way things were going. At that point in the 50s, when Eisenhower was the president, the whole system of electric everything that had existed had already been ripped up and destroyed. So it was a logical way to do it, especially considering just how massive this country really is.
And the sad part is it literally was a boom. And the biggest boom was right before I was born in the 50s. People, you know, dad worked and we had homes, most of us, and mom took care of the family and there was plenty and there was all these new inventions and air conditioners and refrigerators, just all these things. America was the best of the best. And everyone was so invested in America and so proud because we were the white knights who just saved the world in World War II, as we were told. But all that trust was used and abused. It is only recently that we have become aware of how badly we've been used. So all this time when Americans were proud to be American and they trusted their government, bad things were happening.
Continuing on with Prescott Bush's senatorial career, on December 2nd, 1954, Prescott was part of the large 67-22 majority to censor Wisconsin Republican Senator Joseph McCarthy after McCarthy had taken on the U.S. Army and the Eisenhower administration. During the debate that led to the censor, Prescott Bush said that McCarthy has, quote, caused dangerous divisions among the American people because of his attitude and the attitude he has encouraged among his followers, that there can be no honest differences of opinion with him. Either you must follow Senator McCarthy blindly, not daring to express any doubts or disagreements about any of his actions, or in his eyes, you must be a communist sympathizer, or a fool who has been duped by the communist line. It is said that President Eisenhower later included Prescott Bush on an undated handwritten list of prospective candidates he favored for the 1960 Republican presidential nomination.
Really? So the man who stood up there and warned us about the industrial complex is then going to nominate one of the kingpins of our world. But I'm going to say a thing here. I can't tell you the source, and so I guess you just shouldn't believe me out of hand. But I'm going to tell you a thing that I was told by a person who I accept knows things. What I was told about McCarthy was what he had actually stumbled on was the New World Order, and he had mistaken it for communism. And if that is true, now put that in the context of how Bush reacted to him being in like Flynn with the New World Order. And then I guess we could ask, was Eisenhower a good guy? Was his exit speech truly out of caring for the American people? Is it possible that Bush had him fooled and he didn't recognize him as the globalist? I think it's quite possible, because if I was what I was told about McCarthy is true, he was convinced that communists had infiltrated our country, when in fact, what I have been told is true, he uncovered the New World Order.
In case anyone is not aware, Senator Joseph McCarthy's primary claim during the era of what was called McCarthyism was that there had been widespread communist infiltration in the U.S. government, particularly within the Senate Department. This was taking place during the early years of the Cold War, and anti-communist sentiment was intense due to the Soviet Union's actions and the spread of communism in China, Eastern Europe, and other parts of the world. While Senator McCarthy might not have gotten it entirely right, there is no doubt that there was significant infiltration and corruption with socialist, communist agenda in numerous aspects of the United States. Going as far back as the Manhattan Project, there were spies leaking highly classified information to the Soviet Union, a situation that lasted for decades after. This isn't even taking into account the amount of philosophical damage that was done to the United States by the spread of socialist and communist ideals in places like universities, with professors pushing these concepts on students. A problem which has now snowballed out of control and is very evident with plenty of what we see in today's United States.
It almost seems like the clever world takeover guys were intentionally pushing communism to be found here and there. What we know now, when you look back at what Jason just read, communism in China at one point was obliterated. You know who put it back on the table? Our State Department. Our State Department forced the Chinese faction that had beaten communism, forced them to let these people have a chair at the table again. And so as you see here, McCarthy is saying, wait, we've been infiltrated by communists, particularly in the State Department. To me, this makes me accept what I have been told about what actually happened with McCarthy. And when I go back and look at all the movies and how they're pushing on the censorship and the communist idea, it makes perfect sense. So I guess I can just ask the question, was it actually the New World Order that McCarthy had detected? Is it actually true that this man might have actually been a hero because he had actually uncovered the true threat.
And by the way, a lot of people may not realize this, but China and the United States were allies during World War II, and Japan was the enemy at the time. Japan was invading China, and the United States was helping China to fend them off.
Yeah. Just go listen to The Who's song, Eminence Front. It is truer than true can be. And The Who is making fun because we can't even remember what happened a month ago. You know, a month ago, some person could have been involved and busted in some terrible thing. And 6 months from now, they're running for some important office. And for some reason, nobody covers it. No one can remember it. If it does get brought up, it gets shouted down. Currently, as I speak, Bill Gates is out rebranding himself because he was with Mr. Pizza Pedophile Island Boy. What's his name?
Jeffrey Epstein.
Epstein. So there are endless incidents where he is with Epstein, traveling, doing all these things. So now he's got to rebrand his name. And what is the media doing? They are asking no hard questions. It is all softballs. They're basically licking his you know what. And that's the situation we are in. All the modern aspects of life have been infiltrated by corporations who are taking directives from the top. And this is the world we live in. People forget.
The Yale Corporation, officially known as the President and Fellows of Yale College, is Yale University's governing board, which oversees the university's policies, finances, and long-term strategy. After becoming a graduate, Prescott Bush wasn't done with Yale University. He served on the Yale Corporation from 1944 to 1956. As a member, Prescott Bush would have been involved in policy-making decisions for the university, oversight of Yale's financial health, which would have included budgeting and investments, appointments of university officers, such as the president and deans, strategic planning for Yale's development, including academic programs, campus expansion, and fundraising. The immediate post-World War II era saw an influx of returning veterans under the GI Bill, which significantly increased Yale's student body, and Prescott Bush would have been part of planning and managing this student body growth. Yale also underwent academic expansions at this time, with substantial physical expansions to go along with it. The post-war economic boom allowed for increased endowments and donations, which Bush and his peers would have managed to support Yale's growth. Yale's role in shaping future leaders was a priority, and Prescott Bush's presence on the corporation would have influenced decisions around scholarships, fellowships, and programs that were aimed at preparing Yale graduates for leadership roles in various fields. Prescott Bush's service with the Yale Corporation helped cement the Bush family's legacy at Yale, which would most definitely continue through his sons and grandsons. His involvement ensured that the family remained influential in Yale's affairs for many decades.
I like how you wrote that, referring to it as the Yale Corporation. Nice touch. You know, you're looking at mechanisms to select the best of the best. The people who are involved in the New World Order attempted takeover, which is coming to a head now, they're not stupid people. They are brilliant. These are people who went to Yale, and in Yale were at the top, the cream of the crop at Yale. In the book that I recommended at the outset, you will be told that people were selected at birth and groomed all through that time to be a part of this. Also in the book, because Yale is a good example of that. So we have a university with a secret society buried in it. The Freemasons are mentioned in the book that I opened with, if you're interested, Pawns in the Game. And this group took over the Freemasons. So there is a secret society inside the secret society. And ironically, the man who introduced me to this book said the same thing, where the Freemasons are not bad people. There's a secret society within that secret society. Whereas I tend to say the leadership has gone off the rails. The point is that this little thing that we are talking about, the small aspect of this New World Order we are talking about, has been at it for 350 some odd years now.
Just so you know, while I do appreciate the compliment, the Yale Corporation is actually the official name for that organization.
Oh, wow. They put that right on their sleeve, do they?
Yep. That's what they call the governing body that makes decisions for a lot of stuff at Yale.
All right. Well, we're going to wrap up hour one. We've got a lot more to get through, and it is unbelievable what goes on in our world if we simply would have had newspapers that weren't taken over or media of some kind that wasn't taken over. Stuff like this wouldn't fly because, as the WHO says in Eminence Front, it's a fact. People forget very quickly. And the way that so many of these strategies are done is this hell-bent thing happens, grabbing all your attention, and then some other hell-bent thing happens. And on we go. It's like a nonstop cycle. And at some point, we have to quit biting the hook. We have to pull back and get back to common sense. And this is why I endlessly harp on where truth can be found in nature. Of all the things in this world they cannot claim or take control of, nature is the top of that claim. They cannot make trees and seeds or any other thing from scratch, which is why we are getting the digital world. It is my point of view that the entire reason that we got this digital world is because it's going to help them in their end game to take us over. It is going to be the tracking, the police, it's going to be the whole deal where a very small number of people have a prison cell around everyone else. You buy something, they know. You go somewhere, they know. You say something, they know. This is the reason for the digital world. And what is the digital world? It is a pale metaphor, an inferior Fugazi knockoff of the real natural world, which represents the highest truth. And we need to find and value that foundation from which to make our last stand, which is right now. Anyhow, Jason, anything you want to add?
Well, we aren't even very far into the Bush legacy yet. And oh my goodness, the things that they've already done. We have so much further to go. And this is definitely going to be quite a long episode to get it all in.
It's mind numbing. And I feel like I'm a different species when I look at these so-called people and how they've acted. And then I consider, what if I would have been born? I'm adopted. So what if someone would have adopted me and told me a whole different tale from the time I was in diapers about what's important in the world? Could I be shaped into this? I wonder. I tell myself, not possible. I'm not like that, but I wonder. We know damn well the human mind can be hacked. We know damn well that psychology and all these other things have made things possible that once upon a time probably weren't. But with that, we're going to wrap up the first hour of 614 and take a short break. Again, the book that I suggested at the opening is by William Guy Carr. It's called Pawns in the Game. Don't pay for it. There are free PDFs that you can get their hands on. Also, on our sponsored page, there's a couple products which you probably want to look in. Masterpiece, so many people are taking it. There is a price reduction built into the price, so you don't need a code, but it helps you to begin reducing the metals in your body. It's a critically, critically important thing. The other one is Cultivate Elevate, where there is a discount code of CROW10, CROW10. And again, I don't typically push things like this. My point of view, we're in the end game. Anyhow, hour one is free to everybody at crow777radio.com. That is CROW777radio.com. Members know to log in for access to everything, including the full episode. Members get access to all the forums, comment sections, threads, and they can create top-level topics. They get access to the two-hour film called Shoot the Moon that has 10 awards in the world, which covers all my past telescope work to do with the moon, lunar waves, weird UFO things, chemtrails, and all the things that went with that when I was trying to convince the world that chemtrails were not normal. I think most people finally know that now. But also at the end of that film is the very first time I filmed the so-called second sun, which in my view will become a big deal in the era we are now entering. Lastly, I hope to see everyone logged in as a member for hour two, and I would like to wish everybody everywhere in this world a happy, healthy, and higher-minded new era. Now is the time to stand. This is the end game. There it is. We'll be back shortly for the second half. Cheers.
the enemy of knowing. Ha!